Chapter 3. Infinite Variety. Where, if we may use the expression, the manufactory of species has been active, we ought generally to find the manufactory still in action. Charles Darwin, On the Origin of Species. Peter Grant began to wonder about the variation of animals and plants during his undergraduate days at Cambridge University, the university where Charles Darwin was a fair to middling divinity student. After graduating, Grant went on brooding about variation while studying goldfinches and cardinals on the Tres Marias Islands of Mexico, nuthatches in Turkey and Iran, chaffinches in the Canaries and the Azores, mice and voles around McGill University in Canada. Rosemary came to the subject even younger. She grew up in a village in the Lake District, where she lived very much outside, and she remembers trailing after the old family gardener when she was 4 years old, asking him why individual plants, birds, and people are different one from the next. A row of vegetables, and no two were exactly alike. Birds, you could tell them apart. It was true of all the trees roundabout, beeches, birches, oaks, and ash, and all the common birds, tits, robins, blackbirds, finches. What applies to one animal will apply throughout time to all animals, that is, if they vary, for otherwise natural selection can do nothing, Darwin says in The Origin. Slight variations, in Darwin's view, are what the process of natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing. Variations are the cornerstones of natural selection, the beginning of the beginning of evolution. And as Darwin shows in the first two chapters of The Origin with wild duck bones, cow and goat udders, cats with blue eyes, hairless dogs, pigeons with short beaks, and brachiopod shells, variations are everywhere. Darwin studied the variation problem most deeply, not in birds, but in barnacles. In October 1846, he began trying to classify a single curious barnacle specimen that he had found on the southern coast of Chile. It was the very last of his beagle specimens, an ill-formed little monster, the smallest barnacle in the world. To classify that barnacle, he had to compare it with others. Soon, the working surfaces of his study were littered with barnacles from all the shores of the planet. The classic barnacle is an animal with the body plan of a volcano, a cone with a crater at the top. It colonizes rocks, docks, and ship's hulls. Every day when the tide rolls in, each barnacle pokes out of its crater a long foot like a feather duster and gathers food. When the tide goes out, each barnacle pulls in the feather duster and clamps its crater closed with an operculum, a shelly lid. To mate, a barnacle sticks a long penis out of its crater and thrusts it down the crater of a neighbor. Since every barnacle in the colony is both male and female, this is not as chancy as it sounds. What could be more of a sameness than a colony of barnacles? But Darwin, staring through a simple microscope, found himself descending into a world of finely turned and infinitely variable details. He wrote to Captain Fitzroy, "For the last half month, daily hard at work in dissecting a little animal about the size of a pin's head, and I could spend another month and daily see more beautiful structure." In every barnacle genus, he found astonishing variations. In one genus, the opercular valves, usually very constant, differ wonderfully in the different species. Elsewhere, he found variations in the form of curious ear-like appendages, horn-like projections, and, in one strange species, the most beautiful curved prehensile teeth. Everywhere he looked, individual differences graded into subspecies, subspecies shaded into varieties, varieties slid into species. Which specimens were the true species? Where should he draw the line? After describing a set of forms as distinct species, tearing up my MS and making them one species, tearing that up and making them separate, and then making them one again, which has happened to me, I have gnashed my teeth, cursed species, and asked what sin I had committed to be so punished. Darwin's friends knew just how he felt. The botanist Joseph Hooker wrote Darwin across the top of one letter, "I quite understand and sympathize with your barnacles. They must be just like ferns." This profusion and confusion of barnacles helped confirm for Darwin that one species can shade one into another, that there is no species barrier. In many cases, Darwin discovered one barnacle subspecies, variety, or race, he did not know which to call them, on rocks at the southern edge of a species range, and another subspecies, variety, or race at the northern edge of its range. In Natural Selection, his sprawling first draft of The Origin of Species, he notes that in many of these cases, natural selection probably has come into play and, according to my views, is the act of making two species. Of course, Darwin assumed that the split, the act of creation, would be much too slow to observe any motion in his lifetime, because evolution proceeds at a barnacle's pace. Darwin proceeded at a like pace through his barnacles. I am at work at the second volume of the Cirripedia, of which creatures I am wonderfully tired, he wrote in 1852, when he had been plowing through barnacles for 6 years and still had one more year to go. I hate a barnacle, as no man ever did before, not even a sailor in a slow-sailing ship. Variation is both universal and mysterious. One of the deepest problems in nature, and for Darwin, it was for a long time completely bewildering. He wondered why, if his thinking was right, we see any species at all. Why not a continuous spectrum, from tiny individual variations right up the scale to kingdoms? Why, for instance, do we find a vampire finch and a vegetarian finch? An example that Darwin might have liked, if he had known about the vampires. Why not a whole smooth series of omnivores between the two, with a perfect series of intermediate beaks? Why not a blur, a chaos, an infinite web or Japanese fan of continuous variations? In the sixth and final edition of The Origin of Species, in his chapter Difficulties of the Theory, Darwin puts this objection at the very top of the list. First, why, if species have descended from other species by fine gradations, do we not everywhere see innumerable transitional forms? Why is not all nature in confusion instead of the species being, as we see them, well defined? Very briefly, Darwin's explanation is that the same process that makes varieties also destroys them. In the struggle for existence, some variants do better than others. When we look around us in the Galapagos, or in Jersey, or in New Jersey, the species of animals and plants we see are survivors. Varieties in between them have died off and disappeared, so that after the long lapse of ages, we see only the victors and not the intermediate forms. We see the spines, but not the webbing of the Japanese fan. Thus, Darwin says in The Origin, extinction and natural selection go hand in hand. By this reasoning, if we were present at the creation of new species, if we could locate a point of origin, a place where the tree of life is growing new branches right now, we would see something less distinct and more chaotic. We would see a blur of variations shading from the individual up to the level of the species, or even up to the level of the genus. Wherever naturalists find such a blur, they should suspect that here is a place where evolution is in fast action, where species are in the act of being born. Of course, Darwin thought even this fast action would be too slow to watch. We would know that we stood at the point of origin of new forms not by seeing turbulent motion, but only by seeing a sort of frozen foam from which we could infer the waterfall, an inextricable chaos of varying and intermediate links. The 13 Galapagos finches are just such an inextricable chaos of varying links. Darwin never knew how many links there really are. The chaotic and almost continuous variation in his Galapagos finches, because he brought back only 31 specimens. But he got an inkling of the problem when he watched the experts struggle with them. At first, the ornithologist John Gould named one finch Geospiza incerta, meaning ground finch, I guess. Later, Gould changed his mind and lumped that specimen with another. The fact that Gould ended up with the same total number of species of Galapagos finches as taxonomists currently do is a coincidence, because Gould's 13 were not the modern 13. Taxonomists can be classified into splitters and lumpers. Faced with the diversity of Darwin's finches, some splitters recognized dozens and dozens of species and subspecies. Some lumpers went so far as to call them all a single species. Generation after generation of naturalists made brief pilgrimages to the Galapagos, or puzzled over the specimens at the British Museum and the California Academy of Sciences. There were so many freaks, so many misfits that broke the serried ranks in the museum drawers. The extraordinary variants, one ornithologist declared in 1934, give an impression of change and experiment going on. Naturalists read and reread the reports of those who had seen Darwin's finches alive. They sorted and resorted the stiff little rows of specimens in the museums, and they wondered what on earth was happening on Darwin's islands. Today, most taxonomists consider the 13 species a single family, some say subfamily, of birds. Within this family or subfamily, taxonomists think four groups of species are particularly closely related, and so, for the moment at least, most taxonomists divide the family of Galapagos finches into four genera. In one genus, the birds all live in trees and eat fruits and bugs. In the second genus, the birds also live in trees, but they are strict vegetarians. In the third genus, the birds live in trees, but they look and act like warblers. In the fourth genus, the birds spend most of their time hopping on the ground. This last group is the largest, with six species. It is also, for obvious reasons, the easiest to watch, and from the beginning, the Grants and their team have focused on it. The Latin name of this genus is Geospiza, ground finches. The ground finches are a strange little club in themselves, a microcosm within a microcosm. The membership list includes the sharp-beaked ground finch, G. difficilis, the cactus finch, G. scandens, and also a large cactus finch, G. conirostris. Then comes a trio that has become as familiar to the Grants as Goldilocks' three bears. There is a large ground finch, G. magnirostris, a medium ground finch, G. fortis, and a small ground finch, G. fuliginosa. The large ground finch has a large beak, the medium ground finch has a medium-sized beak, and the small ground finch has a small beak. Within each of these three species, the beaks of individual birds are variable. That is, they blur together, just as we would expect if this is a place where the river is racing and the cosmic mills are turning fast. For instance, the species in the middle of the trio, the medium ground finch, Fortis, sometimes shades into the species above it, Magnirostris, or the species below it, Fuliginosa. The very biggest specimens of Fortis are just as big as the very smallest specimens of Magnirostris, and so are their beaks. At the same time, the very smallest specimens of Fortis are just as small as the biggest Fuliginosa, and so are their beaks. Some of the world's biggest Fortis live on the island of Isabella. Some of the world's smallest Magnirostris live on the neighboring island of Rabida. The largest of the Fortis on Isabella are, even to Peter and Rosemary Grant, almost indistinguishable from the smallest of the Magnirostris on Rabida. You can't distinguish these three species by their plumage, and usually not by their build or body size either. You have to tell them apart by their beaks. In the jargon of taxonomy, the sullen art of classification, the beak of the ground finch is diagnostic. It is the bird's chief taxonomic character.